Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in today. Certainly, if you have some questions for Phil, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Phil, welcome back. And tell you what, all this rain, aside, along with everything else, I mean, all of the tragedies and everything else, we're probably, my guess is, going to be inundated with mosquitoes.
Yes. I don't think this rain is record. None of us have seen anything like it. And I'm not going to say the mosquitoes will be that bad. But, I have been getting complaints from around the state really for the last 3 weeks in various places. But in Madison, as an example, the mosquitoes have been very light,
yes,
less than we expected. Some of the graduate students in Dr. Paskowitz's lab have been out sampling. And what they tell us is that the hatch of these floodwater mosquitoes is very imminent. And the problem with those in particular is they'll go 20, 30 miles, and so they just kind of saturate an area. And so, it's just obvious. You've got that much water sitting in places that hasn't been for a while. You're hatching eggs that are sitting there, and it's usually about a 10-day instance before you see the emergence. Now, with the repeated rains in some areas, they literally get flushed out. So, yeah, that explains part of this. But again, from some of the things that we've been seeing in the last week, it's getting pretty close to unfortunately being what I consider old-fashioned, typical summer mosquitoes, which we have not seen for the most part in the last 2 or 3 years because we have been rather dry in the summer.
Absolutely. Well, lots of people to visit with you, so let's go to the phones and Carrie first in Madison. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I'm really glad that you're on the radio today. I have a couple of bugs, and I'm wondering if they're going to start eating everything in the garden or if they're just going to stay on the weeds. One is a green striped tiny thing, and the other one is a tiny red beetle with long antennae.
Okay.
Boy, I'm unfortunately not enough, I think, to go with what you've got. The beetle with long antennae, I'm not concerned about. I can't think of anything in the garden there. The green stripe thing, I'm not sure if it's a four-line plant bug or a type of leaf beetle. You could tell the difference if you look at them real closely, and this is probably closer than you want to, but the plant bug has a little beak-like feeding apparatus, much like a mosquito, and they suck the juices from plants. They really are not. If you got mint and whatnot, some of the herbs, they're a little bit of a problem.
Okay.
The beetles would be rather specific on the weeds. I wouldn't worry about it because it would be one kind of leaf beetle or another, and most of them are pretty restricted in their diets.
Oh, that's good to hear.
All right. Thanks for calling. Ken in Middleton, on to you. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw an insect that my wife's nephew had taken off in northern Minnesota just this weekend. And it was about the size of a woodpecker. It had bit him and going for blood, but it wasn't a typical woodpecker. My profession before I retired was a forester, so I understand woodpecks. But it had a round abdomen, but then a number of legs up front on the thorax, and it was brown like a woodpecker. It looked like a woodpecker in a lot of other ways, but it just wasn't. And I was just wondering if you had any ideas what that would be.
Boy, I really would have to know exactly the number of legs. The thing about the way a tick feeds, really their feeding apparatus is like your thumb. And they literally cut this into you and then feed for an extended period of time. Unlike a mosquito, which is a quick hit and run, they have to kind of set up their housekeeping and the like. So did it appear that it was attached or did it just bite?
I can't tell for sure because I wasn't there when it bit, and I know they found another one on the curtains in the cabin and stuff like that. But and I assume that it didn't appear to have any wings or anything like that.
Well, I still think we do have a number of other different species of ticks. There are both some soft bird ticks that we call them, the argasids, and then we do have the hard ticks like the dog ticks and the deer ticks. But again, okay, the thing that would define it is legs. If it's got 8 legs, it's got to be a tick. If it has 6 legs, then we're in the insect world. And then it'd be a little bit more hard-pressed, although the immature assassin bugs and whatnot could be very tick-like, maybe not quite as hard-bodied.
Is a soft-bodied tick, is that a little more rare? Or Well, soft, I don't recall ever seeing.
Yeah, soft-bodied ticks prefer birds and bats. And unlike, they do kind of hit and run feed, but they really don't have that shield or shell on their back. In fact, if you look at them, they remind me kind of a raisin. They're kind of warty little critters. The other thing is that their mouth apparatus, rather than sticking right out of the front, is really more underneath the critter. It is capable or possible of having them bite, but it's interesting. Most of the time when I get them, people have found them crawling around their bedroom, and I know they have bats or pigeons up in the attic, and it's not an issue of biting. It's more of an issue of just seeing this tick-like thing crawling in my house, and we really don't get any ticks breeding in Wisconsin in homes under normal circumstances.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Ken. Appreciate it. And Roland in Eau Claire, I believe, is up next. Roland, hi.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I'm just semi-retired, and I've got some grandchildren, and I'm having a lot of fun with them. And one of the things that I've really come to believe is that it's wonderful to try to help educate young children or children in general about respect for the insect world, rather than just something to crush and to get rid of. And the poison, to actually understand and have a little bit of understanding and respect for them. And I'm getting ready to write a second book for my grandkids. I've been to 7 foreign countries now, and it's going to be called My Grandpa Sure Has a Lot of Stories to Tell, and quite a few of them are going to involve insects. And I was going to mention one thing that maybe, I don't know if this has ever happened to anybody, but down in Texas, we were sitting around the house one day, and we were getting bit by mosquitoes quite a bit, and I really did not think we were leaving the door open or anything, but it just seemed like it was getting worse and worse in the house. And I happened to look up on the refrigerator, and my wife was rooting some plants up there, and I see all these wiggly things. So here we're breeding them in our kitchen, and then they're coming into the house and bite us.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, we have some concerns, you know, with people going to rain barrels and whatnot, which is a great idea. And if you buy some of the closed system designs or some of the screen designs, but, you know, right now, one of the things we're trying to get the message across to people is to be careful of those kind of container type situations outside, because with all the rain that we've had, you know, they're probably not draining the rain barrels. Or even flower pots, and you can breed some of these, we call them container breeding mosquitoes, and that's what you must have had. And unfortunately, those are the ones that are more likely to spread some of the diseases like West Nile disease. And so these kind of homegrown mosquitoes really can be more problematic as far as disease issues than the floodwater mosquitoes that we talked about that will be more of a what we define as a nuisance type of thing. And so it is good. You know, 10 days of staying in water is enough to get a mosquito. And honestly, these Culex or container breeders like more polluted water. So I could see that the kind of water you would have associated with rooting cuttings and whatnot would be the kind of thing they would just love.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Roland. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Cy in Minon is up next. Hi, Cy.
Hi. I need your help in identifying a flying insect that we have at the lake, usually at the end of May or the first couple of weeks in June. It's black, jet black, and it's about 3/4 inch long, translucent wings. It likes to land on the aluminum, it prefers the aluminum, deck posts and the boat lift. And it lays masses of eggs there. It's not afraid of other people or anything. It's very slow moving. It lays those masses of eggs. Sometimes it'll lay them on the underside of the cedar on the dock as well. What is that thing?
Well, if I had to guess, there's a group of insects we call fish flies. And, you know, the aquatic association makes sense. If you look at their veins in their wings, we call net vein, many different veins going different directions, which is kind of a sign of a primitive insect. So they almost look a little prehistoric by nature. And they typically will lay their eggs above a water surface so that when they hatch, they can fall down in. And their larvae are caterpillar-like, you know, they're wormy-type creatures, and again, they make great fish food, and that's part of where the name comes from. And the adults, relatively short-lived, you know, don't feed at all, don't do anything other than find a mate and whatnot. So that would be my guess, is that you've got fish flies in. Those are one of the smaller species. You know, when you get into the Dobson flies, which are closely related, you've got critters that are sometimes up to 4 inches in length.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, do these things hatch out of the water?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, well, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Cy. James and Stevens Point, on to you. Hi, James.
Hello, thank you. We have stuck to our house these teeny little, they look like a collection of sticks, and they're just as teeny as can be, and they're almost like glued on one end, mm-hmm. and inside is a little like worm-like creature.
Yeah, you have what we would call a bagworm. And what you'll find is if you do a search on bagworms, they'll talk about this great big species that lives in white cedars south of us. But really, it's a whole family of moths. And like the clothes moth, the caterpillars make little casings and live inside it. And they usually use plant debris of the plant that they feed on. So sometimes it's little pine needles, sometimes it's sand grains, depending on the species. And they spin their cocoons down in this case, and they attach it to structures. And that's what you're seeing. And so even if the worm is gone, the case is still there.
Right.
So the good news is, you know, other than getting out there with a broom and just kind of sweep it away, it really isn't much to worry about. If it really got out of hand, I would say try to look to the plants close to the house to see if you can find where they really are feeding and breeding. And then if worse came to worse, that's what you'd spray as the plant to kill them before they get to the house. Because all they're doing with the house is just using that as an attachment. To transform into the adult moth and go from there.
So they're not doing any type of damage to our plants or whatnot, other than attaching to
them. They're feeding a little bit on the foliage, but it shows you how innocent they are because it doesn't catch people's attention that there's any leaf tissue missing. What catches their attention again are these little cases that are attached to the side of the house and window screens and that kind of thing.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling. On to Elizabeth in Madison next. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I got some little praying mantis egg casing things at the garden center, and they just hatched, and I put them outside, and I'm wondering, first of all, how much do they actually eat in the garden? Like, how effective are they, really? And second, how soon can I expect to see a dent in my aphids?
Well, you know, the aphids, maybe when they're young, they'll have a little interest, but I think... You know, I sometimes say that praying mantises get better press than they deserve. Now, one of the interesting things is that we are now finding the mantids are breeding in our state, which does signify things have gotten milder in the winter because the problem they've always had is the egg cases would freeze out. And when they're small, they'll feed on little fruit flies and gnats and the like, and they'll feed on each other. That's one of the problems is they're cannibalistic. As they get bigger, they look for bigger things to feed on, like small grasshoppers, but they'll feed on bumblebees and other things. So that's one of the things. They don't distinguish between good insects and bad insects. And as they get bigger yet, you will find that they rather would not stay in the garden, but they like to move into shrubbery, you know, honeysuckle bushes, cotoneaster hedges. That's where they tend to be the most effective. And so they are eating other insects, which is good. But if you rely on them to control things like spider mites and aphids, some of the smaller creatures, that's just not in their normal nature.
Not going to happen.
You know, they're more of a flying insect thing, so they'd rather feed on a butterfly than they would on your aphids is kind of where they come from.
Okay, so grab one, put it in a jar for my kids, and give it some fruit flies to nosh on.
Yeah, so you know, if you want to watch that, and I do tell people it's a great thing for the family just to watch because they are very impressive insects. You know, some of those species will get to be 4 inches long in the end of summer, and then you may be blessed with finding an egg case that they lay. You know, they look kind of like a spongy golf ball to me, and then you can bring that in the house and just kind of keep it a little protected and cool so they don't hatch early, and so you can keep the cycle going. There's nothing bad about that. It's, again, I think you can't rely on being your only control method for insect problems out there because, as I said, a lot of things that they like to feed on are not what are giving us the biggest problems.
All right.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Green Bay, you are next. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Morning.
I am calling about gypsy moths. I have been burlapping our oak trees, and last summer I killed hundreds of caterpillars, and then I had one of those gypsy moth traps that I bought at one of the local stores, and the moths just flew into that like crazy, but then they flew out.
Yeah, well, the other thing you got to keep in mind is you're only attracting males.
Right, I knew that, and what I ended up doing was hanging that trap in my horsefly trap that I bought several years ago. So I got a big jar full of moths anyway. But what can I'm trying to help other people around my lake association trap the males, and I wonder what if there's some better solution.
Well, a couple thoughts. We use those traps to tell us where the gypsy moths are. But as far as control, the only way it would be effective is if they fly the same chemical that's attracting the males, the pheromone. They use something called pheromone flakes, and they literally disperse them from an airplane. With the theory is if there is so much of this in the environment, the males will not be capable of finding females. But the way you're doing it, you're catching a few males, but it really will not in the long run affect the population. And so that, as I said, it's a great monitoring tool, but the way you're using it, I would not rely on it as a control method. We talk to people about the most effective way for an individual to deal with gypsy moth is to probably consider using some of the spray oils like the soybean oils on the egg masses in any time from the middle of July all the way until the next of April, because every time you spray an egg mass, you're taking a couple hundred caterpillars out of the system, and it's easier to treat, and soybean oil is easy to work with.
And it's not really a toxic...
Right, right.
Are you saying that you just buy soybean oil
no,
from...
No, if you go to the garden stores, it's sold under Golden Natural Pest Oil.
Oh, okay.
And it's a soybean oil with a little bit of a surfactant that aids in the penetration. So when you see those brown, 50-cent size pieced egg masses on the sides of buildings or on the sides of the trunks, those are the ones you can spray, and you can even do it with just a little hand spray bottle. Now, on a bigger scale, as things get building up, you can really the most effective way is to contract for an aerial application of a bacterial insecticide, and you have to have at least 20 acres to do this. You work through the DNR and the like, and it's a shared cost program, especially in Green Bay, because you've had gypsy moth for so long. You're not in the slow the spread campaign. So on a larger scale, if gypsy moths really get out of whack, that really is the most efficient way of dealing with them rather than treating each individual tree. I mean, somebody could come by, a company could come by and spray every tree. That's another option. But when you have these bigger areas and so many trees to work with, that's where the most efficient way is the aerial application. Now, I'll be honest with you, I am really somewhat hopeful with all these rains that we've been having that this will promote this natural fungus disease that helps control gypsy moth. And we had a tremendous outbreak of that disease back in 2004, and it just knocked the socks out of the population. But in 2005, 2006, 2007, we had dry springs. The gypsy moths have exploded, and that's what we're all fighting now. And, I received a number of calls in the last couple of weeks of people seeing little black worms crawling all over their house, and I knew they were gypsy moth and was depressed to hear they were that widespread. And I'm talking many counties, especially in the central part of
the state. Oh, the little black worms are gypsy moths?
Yes.
I thought they were caterpillars with yellow stripes down their backs.
No, gypsy moths, when they're small, they're little black worms that you can't see much on. As they get bigger, they have that distinctive five pairs of blue dots and six pairs of red dots along their back. But we're talking worms that are an inch and a half to 2 inches long.
Oh, I've been seeing those. I didn't recognize what it was.
Yeah. And, the bigger the worms get, the harder they are to kill, especially with the bacterial insecticides. And so, as I said, I think in the long run, the diseases are going to do us more good than spraying. But in the short run, if you've got valuable oak trees, if they get the better of you 1 year, that's okay. The tree will survive. But when you start getting 2 and 3 years of total leaf stripping and defoliation, then the trees become weak enough that they can die from other things. And so it's best to put up the fight on these high-value trees. And as I said, that would be my recommendation. If it's widespread around the lake, is to get kind of together and talk to people and see if indeed you might want to get involved with some of the spray programs that the Department of Ag and DNR are involved with.
All right.
Thank you so much for the information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a bug question, I hope you'll join in as we visit with Phil Pelletieri at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Sherry in Sturgeon Bay is up next. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a rural farm home in Door County,
And it's a remodeled farmhouse. And there's in the bathroom, which is the center room on the main floor, we have a jacuzzi in there, then the other facilities. I'm finding daddy long legs on the ceiling in there right now at this time of year, and then also in the middle of winter.
Okay, the one thing you have to look closely is if it's daddy long legs versus cellar spiders. And the way you tell the difference, they both have the very long gangly legs, but a true daddy long legs only has one body region. It's just kind of like a round seed. Whereas if you look closely at the cellar spiders, there are two sections, one that all the legs are attached to and then the abdomen. I'm guessing they're cellar spiders because daddy long legs are common in the warm times of the year. They're wandering around, and they will wander into all kinds of places, but they're not something we normally expect to survive the winter, whereas cellar spiders, they're just living in your house. So that would be my guess. If it is cellar spiders, to be honest, I think a vacuum cleaner with an attachment back in the corners and whatnot where they're active is as good as any other suggestion I can make as far as taking care of them.
Are they both the same size?
Yes.
Yep.
'Cause normally what I do is I just capture it and take it outside.
Yeah, and that would be fine. But as I said, it would be interesting to look at because, you know, if it's a true daddy long legs, it's always a wandering in kind of situation. And then you start to look at what you can seal up or whatnot to make it harder for them. And if it's in the room in the middle of the house, boy, that just doesn't make sense.
No.
I would think you'd see more of them on the outskirts of the house.
Whereas, I never find them in any other rooms.
Yeah, whereas cellar spiders.
In the middle room.
Well, the other thing that I would look at, if that's the case, is however you have this vented, if you've got any kind of special vents or the like, to make sure that that's not an access point from the outside where things, you know, it might not be screened or caulked in right, and things could find access to that and then kind of crawl in and end up be in the middle of that bathroom anyway. So that would be the other place to look at. But instead, if it's cellar spiders, it's a different story because they live in homes and situations and so there, as I said, we're looking at the weakness in the story here is different.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls here. Thomas is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. Phil, I have a question about honeybees and their significant decline in their populations and other pollinators are being eliminated. What is being done? Everybody's talking about killing insects, but what's being done to save our pollinators? And I just don't think that there's enough sirens going off over the fact that we're losing our honeybees.
Well, I mean, the honeybee story is, you know, the reality is there's a lot of things that have affected our honeybees in the last 25 to 30 years, which have accounted to at least a third of the bees being kept in the U.S. have been lost in the last two or three decades. The varroa mite, various new diseases, and now this colony collapse disorder, which is still not totally figured out, although, you know, the people at Penn State are getting suspicious of an Israeli paralytic virus as being a major culprit here. But you're right. You know, the thing about honeybees is that they are a non-native pollinator that people can manipulate. So humans have taken advantage of that. But there are literally, I just saw a figure that there are 19,200 different species of bees in the world. They outnumber all the mammals and birds combined. And those are just the bees. We're not talking about the wasps and other things that get to pollinate. And we do know that the biggest significant problem there is habitat loss. Mm-hmm. That when we build, you know, parking lots and in you know, bluegrass lawns and whatnot, they're not the environments that the place we see the biggest diversity are the wild places. And this has been of concern, and people continue to at least try to look at it. But you're right. Basically, other than being able to document a decline here, there hasn't been a whole lot of movement on what kind of things we can do to encourage. It is coming to a little bit of a head. I know the Xerxes Society out in the West Coast has made this one of their prime objectives, is to understand and educate the public on the importance of native pollinators. But there's an awful lot we need to learn. And again, I think other than making the comment that we know things are in decline because of habitat loss, and the honeybee thing, there are a lot of people working on it. I mean, this is a major loss. The figures I saw this year for the migratory beekeepers was about a 35% loss again to the colony collapse disorder. And that's not even taking into account all the mite problems and other things that are going on there. So it has been of concern. especially since we are so dependent on them for so many of the crops that we grow that are need bee pollinators to be around.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. Kelly in Onalaska will move to you now. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have a question about, we've got several puddles around our home where I think the mosquitoes are probably busy breeding, and I was wondering what I could do. My mother-in-law says to pour some corn oil in them, and that'll keep the mosquitoes out, but is there anything else I can do, or is that an effective strategy?
I mean, what I always tell people is, even though we talk about standing water, is until I see evidence of the mosquitoes breeding there, I don't get too nervous, and the immature stage of mosquito is called a wiggler, and boy, is that descriptive, because they're a little maggot-like creature, and if you disturb them, they literally wiggle their way down to the bottom of the pond or puddle, and then in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, they have to come back on the surface to breed. So if you don't see any wigglers in the water, it's not a sight. The other thing we'd say, if it's at all possible, the drain is the best way to go. They used to use various oils, and they do work in some circumstances, because what the oil does is put a film on the top surface and suffocate the mosquitoes. Now, the other thing is there's a bacterial insecticide that you can pick up, the mosquito dunks and the like, that you can throw in fish ponds and other environments, and it kills the immature stage of the mosquito, but yet it's selective. It doesn't kill other kinds of insects. The only dilemma there is, technically speaking, because that is a water of the state, you have to have a DNR permit to treat any unlined water source. And I will be honest with you, is if you as an individual tried to get a permit from the DNR, they would not give it to you. Now, I will tell you that this is not necessarily something I agree with. I understand some of their concerns, but the whole permit process is a little out of whack, if you want my personal opinion. Now, these mosquito dunks are available. People could use them. Without the permits, you are breaking law, but that's an option that people have. And again, it comes down to the issue that anything that is defined as waters of the state is under the jurisdiction of the DNR, and the DNR does require permits for using this bacterial insecticide. And the permit process takes a few weeks to go through, and although they have granted it to municipalities, they don't seem to grant it to individuals.
All right. Thank you for calling, Kelly. Annette in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Annette.
Hello. I am currently raising monarch butterflies for release from a milkweed patch that gets mowed down. And recently, this is my first time doing this, and three of the monarch caterpillars fell ill. It looked like they were going to cocoon, but they just kind of turned stringy and shrunk. I've also noticed recently little small red, I don't know if they're egg sacs or cocoon-type things, and one, it looked like fly larva, but it's very reddish, and they're about the size of a black bean, if not a little bit smaller. And I'm trying to find out what kind of fly that would be. And any suggestions on how to prevent that from happening in the future? This morning I came home and there was 9 chrysalis, and one of the little red fly egg things is hanging from one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like any animal, monarchs have a number of problems. They get virus diseases, they get bacterial diseases, and they have a number of parasites. If I had to guess, it could be a tachinid fly, because those are notorious for laying their eggs on caterpillars, and their maggots devour the internal part of the caterpillar, either in the caterpillar stage or the pupal stage. But there's also parasitic wasps that can do similar things. And so that's the problem you find. If you can get eggs and raise them yourself in a closed environment so that these kind of parasites don't get access, you usually have a far better success. In a natural setting, if you're collecting caterpillars, I would expect easily to see 50% or more of the caterpillars to have parasites in them.
Okay, I mean, just when I collect them.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, the earlier you get them, the better. That's probably the best way to put it, in that they're less likely to have parasites. But and as I said, the tachinid fly is a whole family of parasitic flies. The ichneumonid and braconid wasps are big families of parasitic wasps. And unfortunately, monarch has to put up with a number of species of those groups.
Mm.
Okay.
Tough world out there.
Yeah, it is. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. June in Vilas County, we'll go to you now. Hi, June.
Good morning.
Morning.
Larry. I have a question about seedling tomato plants. They were about 6 inches high, and when I checked them in the morning, several days later, they had been in the ground and were doing fine. But I found them severed from the roots and nothing eaten from them, and nearby were three anthills. And I'm wondering if there's any connection between the anthills and the severed tomato plants.
Probably not. It's true that if you put an ant or you plant a tomato in the middle of an anthill, that the ants are not going to be real pleased and can cause some disturbances, but they're more root-related, and the plant just kind of wilts and dies. The description you give me is a cutworm type of problem, which is a type of night-feeding caterpillar, and they're hiding during the day, and they're notorious for feeding on young seedlings and just mowing them off. And sometimes they feed on them, and sometimes you swear they're just doing it to spite you. And so I'm real suspicious that's what got you. And, you know, one of the home remedies, especially if you don't have too many plants sometimes, people, you know, as the tomato gets bigger, the stem gets too tough for the cutworms to feed into. So that's why it's a young plant problem. But some people will take old soup cans or other kinds of devices and literally put a collar around the base of the plant. And it's good to push that at least an inch deep because some of the cutworms will feed from below ground. And that gives a physical barrier so that the cutworm has a much more difficult time finding these young seedlings. Once the plant gets of some size, you can remove them because, again, they'll no longer be susceptible. But I'm real suspicious that that's what got the better of you.
Well, where are they during the day?
Often hide down under dirt clods and other things. Their coloration is often grayish to blackish. You disturb them and they kind of play possum. But if you were to find one, you'll find a darkish smooth-skinned caterpillar anywhere from a half inch up to an inch and a half in length.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much, Phil. That's the culprit then, probably.
Probably. Thanks for calling, June. Good luck. Get those cans out there and you just cut the ends out.
So you got no bottom, so it's a collar if you think about it, and it's a nice physical barrier.
Judy and Sullivan's up next. Judy, hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
We saw a large dragonfly. We have a fish pond, and it's different than the dark blue ones. It was black, and it on the four wings it had like flaps, like an airplane flaps, and it was quite tame. We could walk right up to it, but is that a different type of dragonfly?
Oh, we have a large number of species of dragonflies. A lot of them, you know, to really identify it, would have to see it. I mean, some of them have some very interesting bars and other patterns on their wings. Some of them have little swellings, the club tails on the end of their abdomen. I'm not sure the exact number. I'm guessing we have about 45 to 50 species. There was an excellent book that Carl and Dot Legler had put out, Dragonflies of Wisconsin. I don't think it's in print anymore, but you can sometimes run into that. Although, you know, there's a lot of good guys. There's the Dragonflies of the North Woods is another book. If you go on the internet to look for it, it might take you a little time because, again, there's a lot more dragonfly species that are out there. But if you remember the wing patterns quite well and the general coloration, you might at least be able to get into the general group of dragonflies that you saw.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fairly tame, so maybe we can get a picture of it.
Yeah.
Well, if you get a picture, send it to me. Then I can play with my books and help you identify it.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Do dragonflies really eat a lot of mosquitoes or any mosquitoes?
Yes, I think they put purple martins to shame.
That's what I thought.
You know, and both in the larval stage that's in the water is a predator and would love to feed on mosquitoes. And the adults love to feed on small gnats. And so they're great. And you can just see them kind of moving through and grazing on things. And as I said, you know, so often people talk about bats. And bats do a lot of wonderful things. But bats would much rather feed on night flying moths and beetles. They really don't mess with things as small as mosquitoes. Now, if you convert all the food they eat to mosquitoes, it sounds very impressive. But as I said, I think most of our bats are feeding on larger prey. But the dragonflies, that's what it's all about, is mosquitoes and other little things.
Yeah, so. I was really happy to see a few in our backyard just the other night. And I thought, oh, stay with us. Stay right here. Don't go anywhere. Susan in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. I have two questions. One's mainly on weevils that have showed up about 3 years ago. And I guess with our cooler winters, that might be the reason we're getting them. We're getting really literally hundreds of thousands, I think, of weevils that show up as little ground, they look like coarse ground specks of pepper until about 3 weeks later when they hatch out to a recognizable weevil. And they like to eat some of the semifugas and try to enter the house, but not at an alarming rate. And I guess I was wondering, besides sweeping them all together and trying to crush them, how do you deal with these things?
Well, you know, I'm not sure which species of weevil you have, but I will tell you that there has been at least four or five species of European weevils that have moved into our state, and they breed on the roots of various forest plants. And then very often they come out in June and July and just kind of march through an area, and the numbers can be impressive. And as you said, they kind of come inside. They don't do a whole lot of damage other than being a nuisance. And then some of them feed on various plants, some of them don't. So more often than not, we have a nuisance problem. But the issue is, boy, there isn't much practical other than just physically taking, you know, vacuuming, sweeping up. You can spray a little bit, but you're not getting at the source of the problem. And the source of the problem is usually nothing to do with your property. It's the ground and the roots of the plants around you. In fact, again, we've got some graduate students doing some work on the dynamics of these weevils, how they are changing the plant communities. Because we have a suspicion that they're having some impacts here. And they've all made it in the state probably in the last 3 to 4 decades. More of these problems are up north than I see down south, but that's also where you see more of the natural woodlots and whatnot coming in. So, we can talk about spraying along the outside foundation to just kind of knock them down, but that's all you're doing is you're kind of preventing them from coming inside. You're really not solving long-term the problem, but I don't think it's practical to serve it long-term.
All right.
Okay, and can you tell me briefly, what are the little teeny insects that are feeding on the young squash and lettuce right now?
Do they hop when you disturb them?
Don't even see them. All I do is come out and see that there's some damage. I'm not sure if it's happening at night or not.
Okay, well,
it's little teeny little holes on the end.
Well, teeny little holes usually translate to flea beetles, and that's
okay.
What I was asking is there a little shiny beetle that if they're there, they in the way I describe their damage, it's kind of like somebody shot a shotgun and all these little BB-sized holes appear on the leaf. The other thing I'd be cautious of is if you're in an area that's prone to earwigs, they are just starting to come out of the ground. I've noticed in our perennial beds that they've started to pick on plants quite heavily, and people often don't realize because, again, the feeding's at night, you know, and so if plants aren't producing flowers, or marigolds is my one indicator plant. If my marigolds start to grow backwards, I know the earwigs are active. Now, the squash, usually they'd be less prone, but a young squash maybe. The lettuce, that's pretty tender eating, so that may just be what's going on. There, though, just go out at night with a flashlight.
Okay.
You know, that may be the best way to tell you if they're really starting there.
Okay. Right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects now with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And Dick in Middleton is up next. Dick, hello to you.
Hi there, guys. An aside before my question, Phil mentioned a book or two that might be out of print. I'd remind people that that book that's out of print is probably down at your local library.
That's right.
Even though you can't buy a copy, and if they don't have it locally, they can borrow it from another library for you.
That's a good point.
Meantime, my question is about milkweed and the monarchs. For several years, I've been avoiding cutting down my milkweed. It tends to grow along fence lines out here in the countryside, but I also have it scattered here and there, not great big clumps in fields that I mow. And over the last several years, I have not seen any kind of insect activity at all on them, on any of it, whether it's near the fences or out in the open fields, that kind of thing. And I guess I'm tempted, just from the point of view of efficiency, to start mowing it all down as I go by it instead of taking these long detours around it. And I was curious if not seeing activity in the past probably means there wouldn't be any in the future, too.
Well, you know, there's a gentleman I know, Andrew Williams, who has spent an awful lot of time looking at the dynamics of milkweed and all the critters that you associate with it. And there's a number of beetle species, some pretty neat red beetles with little black dots and long antennae and the like. Now, the case of the monarch itself, because they migrate in, it's always kind of a roll of the dice, you know, that they might not find the patch for 2 years, and all of a sudden 1 year they show and they're everywhere. And so if your intent was to try to promote monarchs, I would say leave the patches. because it's just a matter of time. I saw my first monarch in our backyard about the 20th of May, which is maybe about normal to see come in. And we have some swamp milkweed that they get, and also some butterfly weed. And I would say probably 2 out of 3 years I find a caterpillar or two developing on those, even though we see quite a few butterflies come through. And normally in a more open rural area, you'd think you'd have a better chance. So as I said, I think if you're patient, you're going to hit a good year one of these years, and they'll come back if that's really your intent is to promote monarch populations.
I hadn't seen any insects of any sort, and I've been pretty diligent about looking at them at different times of the day over the whole seasons. So,
well, the thing that you'll see,
I'm not pesticiding anything anywhere nearby or anything.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the other thing you'll see, there's a black and brown fuzzy, almost tufted worm, which is a type of tussock moth that is quite commonly seen on that milkweed. The beetles themselves, their grubs feed on the roots of the plant, but then when the adults come out, you'll often see these big gouges chewed, and you may see the beetle on the plant. They tend to be there. There's also a big leaf beetle, almost looks like a giant ladybug that's associated with monarch, with milkweed. So as I said, there's a number of plant insects that are dependent on it, and it just sounds that you've had a little bit of bad luck more than anything else, I would think.
Yeah. I must really be immune because I haven't seen any damage of any sort. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood City, you're next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. I've got two questions. One of them is I have a big horse facility, so I received some information about fly predators, which are tiny wasps that control flies by feeding on the pupa stage. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, and it has some merits, but what you have to sort through is there are more than one kind of fly in a horse barn. The fly parasites in particular are very good for house flies. You have to get them on a regular basis through the summer and release them. And we're finding many dairy farmers in the state are using that same technology as a way of controlling their flies without pesticides. But there are other flies, like stable flies, that often do not breed on your property. Stable flies can come from 20 miles down the road. And so the parasitic flies that are going after the maggots of these various flies don't have any stable flies available to feed on. And so, as I said, as long as you understand the limitations that certain flies that are breeding on your property will be controlled, but other flies that are coming in from elsewhere will not be affected because you're not at the right source of the problem.
So the best management practices would be to put these flies out throughout the season. I mean, the predator out throughout the season.
Well, you know, they do some natural reproduction, but in the case of, you know, if you read the directions for most of these things, they'll talk about how many head of livestock you have. And, you know, it's interesting, they'll often recommend higher numbers of parasite releases for young animals than adult animals. And that has a lot to do with both the way they're reared. And, of course, young animals tend to generate a lot more waste, which is better for the flies to breed. So there's that association. But often the releases are suggested every couple weeks. I mean, if you're really serious about it, you have to keep on trying to overload the system so that you have a good chance that most of the maggots out there are going to get parasitized.
Okay. And thank you for that. And my other question is, do dragonflies bother hummingbirds at all?
Boy, that's too much for them to take on. And I know praying mantas at time can feed on hummingbirds.
Right,
I've seen that picture.
Right.
But dragonflies, no. Just the way their mouth part is, just the strength of their legs, I can't see where they would even attempt. And we don't see dragonflies going after that big a prey. I mean, anything over about a half-inch size moth is more than they can usually take.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Barb in Milwaukee, you are up. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I have a question about what can I do about the ants in my vegetable garden. They're not regular ants. I suspect that they came in on some composted cow manure that we put down maybe 2-3 summers ago. And these ants are slightly reddish-brown in color. They're very aggressive, and they bite. And they bite really hard. And if they bite on your shoe or your sneaker, they hold on with such tenacity, you can't just brush them off. You really have to rub at them, and then usually their mouth part might break off.
Mm-hmm. Well, the genus is Formica. We call them field ants. They're not an ant that likes to come indoors, but you describe, I mean, two or three things that are very characteristic is they often make large mounds. They are very aggressive when disturbed, and they bite. They don't sting, but that's still a very unpleasant thing to have this little pinching ant latched onto you. And to be honest, at times they are very difficult on plants because they don't like their nest to be disturbed, and they can inject formic acid into the roots of plants and literally kill it. In fact, there's one species in particular that we see kill Christmas trees, even as high as 3 or 4 feet. Because, again, it doesn't like its nest being shaded, and it knows how to take care of the tree. Now, the difficulty in treating it, I will tell you, with any ant, you kill the queens and the colony's dead. The trouble with these kind of ants is that the queen might be as far as a foot or 2 feet deep into the ground. The other problem is they don't bait worth a darn. You know, with a lot of ants, we have special baits you can put out. The workers pick it up. They feed everybody in the colony, and it knocks them out, and I have no confidence in any of the baits that are being sold against field ants, so that takes that away from a possible control. I've had some people tell me they've had some limited success with boiling hot water, but these are usually small mounds. And the thing about field ants is the colony can be in the same site for upwards of 10 to 12 years, so they're very long-lived. So, you know, on the organic side, I'm somewhat handcuffed, but on using some of the synthetic chemicals, what the suggestion is to get a metal rod or stick or something that you can poke 3 or 4 good holes deep down into the ground. So you're basically making some channels to get this product that you're going to use down to it where the queen will be found. And I often just use a bucket and mix up many of the standard garden insecticides that would be more than adequate. So you mix them up according to label directions, you know, a teaspoon to a gallon, and I drench so it soaks down into the ground. So, you know, insecticides that are commonly used in the garden like malathion or permethrin or 7 all could be used. It isn't so much what you use. It's getting it down to where it's going to do the most good. And usually by spot treating those individual nests, that is by far the most effective way to take care of things. If you just treat the surface like people often do, dust a little here, spray a little there, you often see the ants quiet down for 3 or 4 days. It looks like you got them, but all they've done is they're repelled enough by the treatment. The same thing happens with some of the natural oils like wintergreen oil and whatnot. The ants don't like to cross that area, but the colony still exists below there and is still active. And so, as I said, you got to get the queen one way or another. You can try digging it out. That's going to be a lot of labor, and I can't guarantee you that will work. And so, again, I really go back to the point of doing the spot treating and getting the product down in there, and that's really the most effective way.
I see. I have tried mixing boric acid powder with honey, making it a thick slurry, and then I would kind of blob it around on the ground out there, and they'd gather around and they'd eat the stuff, and then they'd be diminished, and there'd be a lot less activity, but they do seem to come back.
Well, see, you know, what's going on there, there's a couple things on the boric acid side. It is a stomach poison, so you somehow have to get them to eat it. Just putting boric acid crystals would not be effective. If they show an interest, I think the main thing is you're not giving it to them long enough period of time to get enough boric acid into the colony to wipe it out. So you're diminishing some of the workers, but you're not killing the queen. She has more offspring, and the colony basically revives from that. So if you found a bait mixture, and I would tell you, if anything, you err for less boric acid than more, because if you put too much boric acid, it can become a repellent or it kills the ants too quickly. You don't want that. You want it to be a slower kill so that the boric acid moves through the colony. There is a taro commercial ant bait, which is basically just that, is a honey sweet base with boric acid. But again, for a large colony, you're going to have to use quite a bit of it. You know, just a little dab here or there is just not sufficient because that colony can have upwards of 10,000 individuals in it.
Good luck. Thank you, Barb, for calling. Sue in Cable, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi, I have an ant issue, but mine is inside the house. And it's an invasion that happens every year. It's a little bit later this year than it usually has been, but all of a sudden, like it was yesterday, and they're everywhere, and I can see them kind of crawling in from a ceiling through kind of a sliding glass door area, and there's a lot of activity all around the deck, around the particular, it's a bedroom where they're mostly coming in a bathroom.
With wings or not?
No wings.
Okay, well, you know, it's hard to say what ant species it is that would be a little helpful, but, you know, some ants, including carpenter ants, go through this phenomenon that we call satellite colonies, where the main colony is out in a tree trunk somewhere, and as they are growing in the summer, they become limited in space, and so they literally send out a small portion of the colony to move into an area. And a lot of times this will be in wall voids and other spaces. So there could be a space in your wall that they're moving up into, will be very active. And then in the fall of the year, when they stop raising young and whatnot, everybody moves back to the main colony. And so if I had to guess, if this has been a repeated thing and you're seeing a lot of ant activity and there's nothing to do with food or anything else that you can correlate it with, is I wonder if you're just seeing a satellite colony moving in from somewhere adjacent.
Okay. And what would be the... In the past, my husband had put, which I don't like to use at all, chemicals, but he put diazinon around the outside, you know, just the perimeter along the decking. And I placed some ant baits. I think we've used taro in the past. The diazinon, I think, did help.
Yeah, well, what that is a barrier treatment. You don't kill the ants, you just keep them away, you know, yeah. Which is fine, you know, if you understand that. There are other chemicals now that diazinon is not available that will do the same thing.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Mentioning the Energy Fair, Jim Packard and I and the gang will be at the Energy Fair on Friday. We'll be broadcasting live from the fair. From 11 to 12:30. So, boy, if you're in the area, I hope you'll stop in, say hi, and take a look at all of the great things that you're going to find at that Energy Fair. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we are definitely looking forward to being there on Friday. We'll be there from 11 to 12:30. I think we'll be in one of the big tents. But you'll be able to find us. If you're in the area, please stop in. Right now, though, we're talking insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, and Leah in Stevens Point has a question for you, Phil. Hi, Leah.
Hi. I live in the second floor of an old house, and I've just found a lot of carpenter ants, and I also have noticed quite a few, I think, millipedes or centipedes, and I know they go with old houses, but I just wondered if you had any tricks for either of these annoying guys.
Well, the carpenter ants, I would really be suspicious. If you're seeing a big pattern, is they are nesting in the building, and that's something I think that the landlord should be made aware of. I always tell people it's not the end of the world because they don't eat wood, but they often nest in stuff that has been compromised or water damaged, which, you know, could be a significant structural issue. As far as treating them, if you don't know where the nest is, there are baits out there, but you've got to do a little bit of legwork. They're not at the local hardware store. You can go to some of these do-your-own pest control sites, and there's an advanced carpenter ant bait. There's a Max Force carpenter ant bait. There's a gel. The whole idea is you put it out, they pick it up, take back, and feed the rest of the colony. So that's a way of dealing with it, and it really is a less toxic way than some of the sprays. Okay. I'm guessing you've got centipedes. Millipedes are kind of an outside, live-in-the-ground thing that sometimes come in, and second floor is getting a little high for them. Centipedes are predators, and so they're out cruising at night, very secretive normally, but they scare the bejesus out of people because they have those big gangly legs and the like. You know what I often suggest for people there is they sell these little, when they sell the bigger versions, they call them glue boards. But it's basically just a tacky cardboard, piece of cardboard. And if you put these underneath a refrigerator or in a stove or back in a closet. Now, if you got pets, you got to be a little careful because you don't want your cat to be rolling in this because it'll get stuck on them. But the whole idea, this is a passive trap. And when the centipedes are out running, they'll run across to get caught. And centipedes are very slow to breed. You know, so it's not as if you're going to, you know, have one today and have 52 weeks from now. And so by just kind of passively removing these individuals from the population, I won't say you will eliminate them, but you'll definitely reduce it rather easily, I would
sure.
say.
Sure. Thanks.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, Leah, for calling. Appreciate it. And more callers online. Let's go to Rich in Hudson next. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Yeah, I have got some amugo pine, and there's these little clusters of small caterpillars, about 2 millimeters wide, maybe about 1.5 inches long, maybe.
Yeah, they're just about done. They're an animal we call a European pine sawfly. They love the imported pine, so Mugo Scots and Austrian. I've got some great pictures this year of, you know, when they feed, they only eat the old needles.
Yep, exactly.
And they leave the new candles going, and they start feeding normally in most of the state about the second week of May or so. Feed from May into early June, and then by this time of the year, at that 1.5 inches, so I mean that's when you see them, but the damage has already been done. They won't be back again till next year, but they will be back. I mean, they're a pretty predictable insect. So for now, I think you could probably let them go, but somehow remind yourself to check the plant earlier, because, you know, in that early activity. You can kill them with soapy water. You can kill them with almost any landscape spray. Okay. But then you'll have a chance to have an impact before they have a chance to knock the plant back. And, you know, the plant will look kind of bristly and thin for a while, but it will fill in as those candles expand. So it's not a life or death type of issue, but it definitely affects them cosmetically. And as I said, I got one neighbor who's got a huge mugo pine every year. He pays no attention to it. I get great pictures. But even going for a walk with my wife, this was a small Scotch pine that was, you know, like a perfect little Christmas tree. And right now you look at it, it's a Charlie Brown tree because of the pine sawflies.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Rich. Louise in Hillsboro, on to you now. Hi, Louise.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a maple tree, and I noticed a couple weeks ago, it's one I planted about 6 years ago, and it's been growing beautifully, and it leafed out beautifully this year. And I went to kind of look at it and looked at the leaves, and all over the leaves are these little orange dots that were stuck to the leaves. Now, I haven't seen it since all the water and the flooding, but and they were just, they weren't really clumped up, but they were all over the leaves.
Right. It's really plant tissue that you see, but it's caused by a little mite, and we call this a gall. This one's called a bladder gall. There's also a long, skinny one called a spindle gall on maple. There's also a red, velvety one on the underside of silver maple that we call an erinium gall. In all cases, it's cosmetic. In all cases, once you see it, you couldn't do anything anyway because you would have to kill the mites before they cause the plant to grow that way, which means spraying at bud break. And because it's cosmetic and it kind of comes and goes on its own, we tell people just don't worry about it. Nothing to be concerned about.
Oh, that's such good news. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Louise. And John in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, John.
Good morning. Hi, Phil. I'm calling about a clematis plant that is located across from the Menominee River in Milwaukee. I'm wondering if you know of any creepy, crawly, flying thing that might behave in the way that our plant is reacting. Every year, it blossoms, and then the petals on the blossoms fall off, leaving the pistil and stamen and the rest of the flower.
So, in other words, they seem to be falling prematurely.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I don't know of any critters. I mean, I have trouble with Japanese beetles showing up and munching on the petals, and you see these big gouges and whatnot in the petals. But that sounds more hormonal to me, you know, more of a plant chemistry type thing. But I'm really at a loss to say what causes
it. Well, I have searched at night and daytime trying to find something, crawling or whatever, and have never seen anything. So you may be onto it.
Yeah, I've seen earwigs too, you know, cause some injury on them at times. But again, those are pretty obvious, especially at night. And again, it's more of a chewing, gouging, you know, type of thing rather than just that full petal fall. I just can't think of any critter. You know, in some other plants, we get little weevils and stuff that do some silly things to the buds and cause the whole flower bud to fall, but not just the petal. So as I said,
this is exclusively the petal.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. Marilyn in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. There's an email that's going around, and I'd like to know what the validity of it is. And they say to spray your area, like your grass, with Listerine to repel mosquitoes.
Doesn't work. Wish it did, but
okay. Well, I won't go out and buy the Listerine, I guess.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. That's probably a question others had, too. Ann in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I live on the edge of a forest, and there are no other houses around me, and I get a lot of these little tiny bugs that come in my house if I leave any lights on. It seems like they're attracted to light and can just get through my screen. Is there any way to repel them from the house?
No. The two things you have to look at is changing the kind of lights. And it depends, you know, if it's a security light outside that's drawing them in, there are bulbs that are less attractive, you know, some of the sodium vapors and yellows. If it happens that it's the kitchen light and, you know, when you're busy washing dishes and stuff and people are in the kitchen, that's drawing them in. I would look seriously at the size of the screening you have. You know, there is finer screening, mesh screening, that will basically prevent any critters from getting through it. And in particular, it may not be. It's only one or two windows that are giving you the problem. And so, you know, not that you have to rescreen everything in the house, but that would be the direction I would look at. Because if you can solve the riddle, you've got a permanent solution. You just don't have to worry about them anymore. There are a bunch of critters. That's one of the more common things that I identify for people is these various miscellaneous insects they see in the house, and I come back to them and say, well, these creatures don't breed in the house. They have no business being there, but they're strongly attracted by lights at night, and that's what draws them in. And people by lakes have it even worse because there seems to be an awful lot of aquatic insects that love to come in. So, as I said, it either has to be in a light adjustment or a screen adjustment, because I don't know of any kind of chemical you could spray that would really be a true repellent to the diversity of things that would be drawn in.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Lois and Kimberly, you're up. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I have a problem. I have a little insect that is in my bathroom. It's either coming from, in the winter months, it came from the sink drain, and now I think it's coming from the bathtub drain, and I don't know what to do to get rid of them.
What do they look like?
It's just like a little tiny black speck, and they fly around. And I did try pouring hot water down the kitchen or the bathroom sink in the winter months, and I seem to have gotten rid of them.
Okay.
But now they're back, and they're, like I say, I just was down there about 10:30, and there were six of them that I killed with flying around the walls and near the toilet and everything.
And they leave kind of a little powdery a splotch when you crush them?
Yeah, it's kind of a little black dot, not even the size of a pinhead.
Okay, well, that's a little small. What I was thinking is you might have a beast that we call a drain fly.
It's something like that.
But what it is, it isn't so much the drain itself is in the bathroom sink. The overflow cut is where I'd be concerned because they need the combination of moisture and organic matter. And usually you flush enough through the regular drain that nothing accumulates. But in the overflow cut, it stays kind of damp. And so the hot water is not a bad idea.
Okay.
But it's just putting it in the right spot.
Right.
The other thing, sometimes you have to use a little plunger or some other kind of mechanism to kind of flush out that stuff.
Okay.
And, they will accumulate where it's damp. So sometimes you see them in one spot because we see these breed in floor drains all the time.
Yes, yeah. That's what it's something like, those little black things that breed in the floor drain.
And so, as I said, I would check the overflow cut, and there may even be an overflow cut for your bathtub. Sometimes around the mechanism that opens and shuts the drain, there's a little cut that water can get up into if you've got a lot of water in the bathtub.
Okay.
And the same thing, get that cleaned out, because if there's no organic matter, if it's just water coming through, they couldn't breed.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Lois. Pam in Marshfield, on to you. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
What can we do?
I'm sorry, I have a little problem with springtails in our basement in particular. And wondering if there's any really good ideas. We've tried just about everything, spraying inside, spraying outside. We do live, I guess our backyard is a marsh, but just don't know what to do with them anymore.
Would you seem to see as many or more outside than you do inside?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they crawl all over the outside of the lower part of the outside of the house.
Yeah. See, the issue with springtails is in good, rich organic matter soil, they are the most dominant insect that you see. And I can't remember the exact figure of how many gazillions per acre there could be. And so, the easy thing to say is, well, if you could dry things out, they'd be gone. Well, that's not practical. In sprays, what you're doing is you're killing the ones that are up out of the ground now, but in a week's time, more can either blow in or come crawling out of the ground. And so there really isn't any real easy answers here. Some sprays last longer than others, but none of them really stop the breeding. And again, it's an artifact of being in somewhat lower ground and having such rich soil is where we tend to see them from. Now, in the basement, I would just do two things. Anything you can do to keep it drier, and I'm sure you probably got a dehumidifier, but keep pushing that side because they don't do well where it's dry. But I would also look very carefully where your foundation meets the siding. They're probably crawling up underneath there and falling into the basement. So anything you can do to get that tightened up, expanding foam or something else that will prevent them, because, to me, if a bunch are falling in, they're having an easy time of getting in, and that may be a way of at least alleviating the indoor problem. As I said, the outdoor problem is going to be very difficult just because of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't seem to bother anything
as far
as plants.
They feed on decaying organic matter, and so You know, once in a while I've seen some reports of in greenhouses of bothering little seedlings, but that's really very rare. Most of the problem is just a moisture problem and a nuisance problem. And again, the numbers, these when they come out in March, we call them snow fleas, and people can see them 2 inches deep sometimes, and just the numbers are staggering. And as I said, anytime people find them, I know that they have to have that combination of good organic matter and things staying moist and damp, but that's exactly what you'd expect in being in lower ground.
Sure.
Right.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
And Daniel in Madison, your turn. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Phil. I'm calling about a problem that has existed a few months outside my house. That looks like a long part of the foundation. There are some ants maybe burrowing underneath there because there's what looks like kind of sand along that stretch. And I've just been looking there right now, and there are a few ants crawling around there. But, you know, I hope that they are not undermining my foundation. I don't know whether this thing is, you know, what I described as sand, whether it might be some nibbling from the wood in the foundation, et cetera, et cetera. I just would like reassurance that this is not undermining the foundation.
Well, if it was cement and whatnot, ants just are not capable of feeding into that. It would be important to look at the debris they're kicking up because it gives you a little indication, are they just in the ground and kicking up soil, or are they, again, if it was pieces of styrofoam or other things, then you know the ants are probably above the soil in our nesting in. And it's still more of a nuisance problem in that case. I mean, we don't normally look at ants as being a structural problem here, but it does show you that they're living in the walls, and then it probably is worth addressing it. So if you can get that debris and look at it with some kind of magnification, you can always send it to me. And it would be helpful even if you had a couple dead ants, because if I knew what ant it was, I'd have a little bit stronger suspicion of what's going on. But I still think it's more of a nuisance. Sometimes I've had people tell me their masonry's fallen apart and they think the ants are doing it, and it's the other way around.
The other way around.
Because when it breaks apart, the ants will move into the environment.
Could you tell me, the building you used to be in was torn down?
No. At least the 30 years I've been around, I've been in Russell Labs. Now that, you know, entomology, if you go way back, was in King Hall, but I'm in Russell Labs on the second floor across from the Babcock Ice Cream Parlor. my office is 240, and so, but you can always mail things. My address is 1630 Linden, Linden Drive. University zip is 53706. And if you send it to the insect lab, I will get it because I am it.
You are the guy. Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Greg in Lodi, it's your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thanks for having Phil on again today.
Sure.
I am occasionally finding carpenter ants in my home, and I've followed them around, and I've tried to find out where they could be nesting, and I'm never finding any frass. And I know it's a difficult thing, but I'm just wondering if they could possibly just be foraging. And the scenario is I have wood mulch around my house, and I live at the edge of a very large woods. Am I attracting the ants to my house by putting that wood mulch around? Are they attracted to that?
No, because it is not a solid enough substrate for them to nest in. And I guess what I would tell you, it's the pattern. If you saw any ants in January, they got to be nesting indoors. If you saw a bunch of wingforms show up in the bedroom windowsill one day, they got to be nesting indoors. But if what you're seeing is that in the warm times of the year, once you get to, well, maybe the first middle of April, all the way till about the 1st of November, if you just see an occasional ant wandering in, I think you hit it on the head. You're just watching some foragers coming in looking for food. And you might see this explosion one day. You know, if somebody left a pop can on the counter and the ants found it, you might see 50 ants run around on the counter just because they've discovered that there's a free food source here. But unless there's this pattern of them being a couple things. Aside from the time of the year, if most of the ants are in the kitchen, that suggests to me foraging ants. If most of the ants are seen in other parts of the house other than the kitchen, that's hard to explain other than to say, well, those stinkers are nesting in a wall void or a hollow core door or, you know, in a bad piece of roofing. So as I said, the pattern to me, when what goes on over time usually explains. And if it's just a couple ants every day in the kitchen, Definitely.
That's generally what it is. It's just they just show up in the spring here every year. And I thought it had to be foraging, but I read some things about satellite nests and things like that, and I could never find frass anywhere. So
And sometimes it's subtle. I mean, in my own household, and my wife will tell people about how we talked about it, because I never would see enough of a pattern to be concerned. And then one day, sitting out on our screen porch, I looked over, and the frass was piled about this little sawdust-like stuff about 2 inches deep, and they were up in some bad wood we had in the ceiling of the porch. And, you know, really was very little signs, but that's what you kind of sit and wait for, is that all of a sudden that one occurrence that they give themselves away. And you know, once I knew where the nest was, you know, could be deal with it real directly. But like I said, you don't seem to have enough of a pattern that I would be nervous yet.
Thanks, Greg, for calling. And Becky in Pulaski, on to you. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is rose chafers. They're inundating my grapevines.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any way to get rid of them? I mean, they're just clumping.
Right.
They're horrible.
Well, the thing about rose chafers is they only breed on sands, and they come in from off your property. So it's not as if you can do something to stop them. But here's one case where trapping has proved to be successful. There is a company called Great Lakes IPM that sells a rose chafer trap. It looks almost identical to a Japanese beetle trap, but they have a different attractant. And people have had some moderately good success with following their directions. It might tell you to buy two or three traps, depending on the size of your property and whatnot, and drawing the rose chafers away from the grapes into the trap, and they will die. Now, with Japanese beetles, we tell you it doesn't work. There's too many beetles. You make things worse. But with rose chafer, I have some pretty good confidence that the traps are a good way to go. And as I said, Great Lakes IPM, I think you can get on the Internet. In a perfect world, you would have had the traps a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. I thought of the traps earlier, and I just didn't know where to get them. So Great Lakes IPM.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Maybe next year I'll be able to get them.
Okay. Thanks, Becky. Thank you for calling. And Mary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have an ID question about what I think might be a fly that I see a lot of in my woods, but it's probably 3/8 to a half inch long. It has a wedge-shaped body, black wings, and a kind of an orangish, yellowish piece, like a on the back of its head, I guess, or below the back of its head. And I'm wondering if it is a fly, what it is.
Mm. Okay, flies are particularly difficult to identify. And in fact, even things that look like house flies can turn out to be 50 different things. The way I would verify it was a fly, if you could look at one close enough, all true flies only have one pair of wings, whereas all other insects we deal with have two pairs. You know,
and
if it had,
I haven't confirmed that.
Yeah.
Yet, so
that would be the one thing. You know, I wonder if it could be a sawfly, which is not a fly at all. It's a primitive wasp-like creature, because some of those would fit that color pattern. To be honest, there's even a few day-flying moths that would fit that pattern too. The moths have very dark wings, but they would have two pairs, and if you ever found a dead one or were to capture one, they would have this very fine powder-like scaling on their wings, which is characteristic of all the moths or butterflies. So those would be some things to look at just to kind of help you sort through, indeed, if it was. And again, if you're ever lucky enough to catch one, you can, or take a picture of one, I'd be more than happy to take a crack at it then and see if we can help you.
And thank you very much for calling. And Phil, thank you. Time flew by.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you back. Phil will be back in about a month, and we'll do this again with him. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist, works out of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Tomorrow, Jim Packard filling in for me. We'll talk about Apple computers and also about life along the Mississippi River. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.